Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Amara. Thank you for making time to talk to me. I know that term has started, and a professor at the beginning of an academic year is always super busy.
I know. Mostly we're busy chasing students who don't come to our tutorial, but we are busy.
Is there an aspect of being an academic that you enjoy more than others? Teaching, ethnographic inquiry, fieldwork, writing papers?
I think it changes, you know. One aspect I personally never enjoy is the administration that comes with it, which more and more universities seem to be expecting academics to do. But in terms of teaching and research, I think it just depends. Like, teaching can be super enjoyable when you have the right group of students. It can really feel arduous work when you don't have the right group of students. And yeah, similarly with research, right? There are good times and there are bad times. At the moment, I feel like I am actually enjoying writing more because I have lots of ideas from my ethnographic inquiry that I'm thinking about, and I guess that I enjoy writing even if it's painful sometimes.
And it doesn't seem to be painful for you. I love your writing, but more on that later. For those listening, I'm just going to share bits of Dr. Amara Maksud's current research in her field of social anthropology before taking her back in time through previous topics and some of the publications they've led to, just so you know why I find her work so fascinating. Amara, I'm going to quote from your biography here, if that's okay. So
Sure.
your current research is concerned with difference, both in terms of its presence in ethnographic settings and what we assume about it in our theoretical thinking. Based on fieldwork on the experiences of upwardly mobile Hindus in Karachi, you are investigating how difference is produced and lived in and through everyday encounters with Muslims. So, in a recent paper, there's a line that really spoke to me. You wrote about the generative power of difference. And let me go to the specific line. It's, I treat difference as productive in that it contains potentialities for experimentation, becoming, and exchange, even as it threatens to disrupt and break apart. Can you tell me a bit more about this?
Yeah, I can expand on it in different ways. So just to kind of give a little context of from, the article where you've taken this line from and what I was referring to before that was, there's a tendency, particularly when you think about security related or political science related discourses on Pakistan, very state centric. And the idea is always that Pakistan is a failed state or at the brink of failing or descending into chaos. And not to say that there isn't all of that chaos, but the idea always is that because of all the contradictions that are there within Pakistan, it's always at the brink of failure, right? So contradictions are seen as a problem. And in relation to that, what a lot of anthropological work has shown is that, yes, sure, there is contradiction. Like, for instance, there's a huge contradiction between the ideas of Muslim nationalism that were behind the Pakistan movement and the regional and ethnic and linguistic attachments of the people who are now parts of Pakistan. And this tension between saying hum sab ek hain, hum sab ek hain, but then people having different linguistic, ethnic associations and the state treating them all differently is part of a lived reality, right? And instead of that leading to failure or it leading to a complete breakdown, which it occasionally does do, that people do descend into violence. For the most part, people tend to live with these differences with each other. And how they learn to live with these differences, how they maintain small moments of peace or coexistence and stuff. That's what I mean by difference can be generative, that it can allow people to come up with new arrangements of living together or new aspects of coexistence can come into being. But if I can just connect this to some of the larger themes that I'm interested in,
Please.
some of it is just that I think what my work at the moment is trying to do, and my work is, like you pointed out, on upwardly mobile Hindus in Pakistan, who, by the way, I don't mean to make their life here particularly rosy at all, face the ever-present specter of blasphemy accusations of persecution, but also a constant fear of being proselytized, right? That someone's going to come and try to convert them. And I work on upwardly mobile Hindus, but I work on them as part of a broader project in which someone else works on the Catholic Church in Italy and how that in Italy, but particularly in Palermo in southern Italy, and how they receive migrants who often are Muslim and refugees and welcome them in, and someone else who works on Muslims and Christians living in Nairobi. And what we're really interested in is that, you know, these are settings that don't have a secular public sphere, and people's religious identities are at their fore. But people do manage to live together to some degree or extent, right? And what are the limits of that? What are the ways in which some religious boundaries are crossed? What are the dangers? And what we try to do with that is we try to play with this idea about how can one live across difference and compare it with what happens in liberal or secular setups with difference, where the idea always is that if people would come together rationally and discuss and debate, they can get over their differences and we can all get along, right? And
Yeah.
we try to think about, and partially that's why religion has to be in the private sphere in a liberal setup, right? Because people can't get along with irreconcilable religious differences. And we're trying to look at instances or places or environments where religious identities are public. They are problems, but there are also pockets within that in which people do manage to have some degree of coexistence. And what does that look like?
I really like the idea of divergence having a positive charge. So I think this concept can be applied across all kinds of things. In the context of the paper that I read this in, that paper in particular is about the work of time, personhood, agency, and the negotiation of difference in married life in urban Pakistan.
Yeah.
I was enchanted by your writing, actually, and I'm generally not enchanted by academic writing, but I thought it
Oh
was
my
really
God,
beautifully
thanks.
written. And I last time we spoke, I'd actually made you read the first paragraph aloud. And I'm really hoping that you can do that for me again if you have it, or I can read it because I already have it.
I actually don't have it up. So if you want to read it, you're more than welcome to, or I mean, let me see if I can bring it up while I'm talking to you.
Yeah, because aapki awaaz bhi bahut pyari hai, and I think agar aap apni awaaz mein isko padhengi to behtar hoga.
I have found it. So do you want me to read the
The
first
first
paragraph?
paragraph, and then yeah, then I'd like to talk about Sabr a bit.
Okay, so here goes. What is the work of time on a marriage, and how does it transform people as they struggle to change and leave traces on others? If time and contingency shape people, altering their behavior and those of others around them, what does this mean for who they are as persons? I found myself asking these questions as I listened to women in Lahore explain how they had been ambivalent and hesitant about marrying men who did not share their own religious aspirations and desires for a pious life. After a few years, however, some found that the religious outlook of their spouses had shifted, and that the men had become more observant and pious. Although they did not deny that they had hoped for and actively sought this outcome, neither did they fully claim responsibility for it. Deploying conceptions of sabr, forbearance, time was used to both mark and explain shifts in attitude, as well as to speak of the contingencies that had shaped their married life and relationship. But just as time had worked on their husbands, it had not left the women unchanged in their own religious practices and beliefs. While some had little time for prayer and learning, others found themselves in states that were in sharp contrast to their earlier desires and yearnings for the future. Agency, the capacity to assert one's own visions and hopes, depends on the malleability and openness of persons to time, leaving those who desire change and others equally exposed to transformation.
Wow, kya kya likha hai aapne. So this
Thanks.
paper examines contemporary usage of the word Urdu word sabr in Pakistan. Why were you so drawn to that word, sabr?
I was drawn to it. I mean, so, you know, just to kind of give a sense, this paper is not about Muslims and Hindus, right? It's about
Yeah.
differences within Islam itself, that some people being a lot more religious than others. And I think I was drawn to the idea of sabr for two reasons. One, that it's such a part of the life in South Asia, right? Sabr karo, sabr se ye ho jayega, sabr wo karo. And it's particularly used in relation to women and the lot that falls on women. And often sabr is kind of seen as to be coming from a place of weakness, right? And as a sign of passivity, or as a sign that you just have to deal with what's there because you don't really have a choice. So, you know, you may as well kind of do sabr. And I try to unpack this a little, that of course there's a degree of lack of control here. There's about a patriarchal setup here that women have to do a lot more sabr. But I was really uncomfortable with this idea that sabr is passive. And also I wanted to dig in more that if we were to think of sabr as something different than passive, then we also have to think differently about what we mean by action and agency and personhood. And so that's how kind of this paper came together.
When we spoke last time, we had also talked about an increased focus when there's been more religiosity in terms of Pakistani society and women in particular embracing religiosity. And a rising prejudice also happened when women became more visibly observant, correct?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, we were talking about this last time. And I think it's such a double-edged sword, right? That on the one hand, it is true that Pakistan has over the years become an oppressively religious environment where there seems to be lesser freedom for divergent religious expression or for people who might not want to be religious, right? And at the same time, what is also happening is that people who are very religious, who are very Islamic, are seen in a particularly negative way and often face the brunt of that discrimination, right? And particularly when it comes to women, what we find, particularly in the middle class circles that I work in, that in the last 20 years or so, you've seen this rise of a very visible religiosity, right? Which is about wearing a headscarf or an abaya. It might be accompanied by going for dars or to a Quran school. And usually, you know, these women in very kind of mainstream liberal press or circles are considered to be, they've become Wahhabi, or yeah, wo itni rigid ho gayi hain, yeah, they've become like really strict. And, you know, the connotations also of becoming too rigid in some ways.
Yeah.
And this article kind of works against that tendency, because even I had kind of heard all of this stuff and assumed all of this. But when I worked with some middle class women who indeed were very religious, I realized that, you know, their piety or their commitment to religious, first of all, it's not constant over time. Life happens, things change. But also at the same time, they have other obligations or there are other pressing needs that sometimes affect how religious or not religious they can be. And particularly in Pakistan, marriage is one of those things.
And marriage in particular in Pakistan, I mean, you mentioned this in your paper that in the diaspora, female-led and female-centered Islamic movements have led to an increased autonomy in marital matters, but that actually hasn't been the case in Pakistan. And women are still seeking to work within the constraints of tradition.
Yes, I mean, it's really interesting because what you hear constantly is this, right? That ye jo saari al-huda type aurte hain, and like those other kind of words that are often used. Like, you know, they don't care about these things and they will just divorce you if they don't think you're a good enough Muslim, or they can be so rigid, they're apni saas ko jo marzi keh deti hain, and all of these kind of things are there. But actually, I didn't find that in my fieldwork, but also when you compare, I think divorce rates in Pakistan in general have increased, but they haven't really increased at par with what we find in the rest of the Muslim world, where female-led Islamic movements have been on the rise. And just to kind of give you an example, like my colleague Julia Liberatore, who works on British-born Somali women, in that generation, you often find that when British-born second-generation Somali women have become more pious, they often use their religiosity to challenge the traditions and cultures of their parents, right? So they might say, well, I don't want to have an arranged marriage like this. I'd rather marry someone who suits my religious values, or Islam doesn't say this, so why are you saying this? This is just your culture.
Yeah.
That kind of discourse might be there in Pakistan a little bit, in that people, women talk about, oh, ye to sara Pakistani culture hai, ya jahez Pakistani culture hai, lekin asal mein yun nahi hai. But in their practical lives, when it comes to marriage in particular, attitudes haven't really changed.
No, they haven't. You had also mentioned in this article, you talked about the idea of agency and desire itself. What do women want? And you've been very influenced by the work of Saba Mahmood, you said, who had worked in this idea of challenging the idea of agency as resistance.
Yeah, I mean, this article has very much learned from the work of Saba Mahmood, particularly in that we don't always have to see agency amongst women in patriarchal setups to just mean resistance, right? That this idea that agency needs to mean that you break away from all the things that oppress your freedom comes from a very Western idea of personhood, but also agency, right? And to submit to a higher authority and cultivate yourself according to what that authority wants you to be is also a form of agency, which is what Saba Mahmood writes about in terms of pious women in Cairo, right? That that women want to cultivate themselves as better Muslims because they've submitted to the authority of Allah. And that cultivation is not false consciousness or it's not oppression, but it's something that they want to do. And this in itself is a kind of agency, or maybe it's a non-liberal agent form of agency, right? So I was very much influenced by this, and I kind of see a lot of work that women put into being better Muslims or cultivating ethics as part of that non-liberal agency. But one of the things that I found in Saba Mahmood's work was that there's a lot of focus on the individual, right? That there's a lot of focus on what the individual can do and cannot do, and that women are able to cultivate themselves into better Muslims by praying, by fasting, by being disciplined, by so on. And while other people have critiqued Saba Mahmood to say, oh, but you know, not everyone can keep up with all of this stuff. And when they can't keep up with this stuff, these religious projects fail, or people feel the contradictions, or there is some kind of rupture or fragmentation. And I kind of found that in my work, what I was finding is that, yes, you know, women want to cultivate themselves, like Saba Mahmood is saying, but it's not always in their control. Other stuff happens, like, you know, they might get married into a family where people are not very religious, or they find that, you know, as someone did in the article that I've written, that she's married into this family and her husband doesn't want her to wear a hijab. And in these particular instances, it's not always that there's a rupture or there's a complete collapse or something, but there is a way of acknowledging that, okay, at this point in time, I haven't been able to do what I wanted to do. And that's a particular kind of recognition that we don't lead these individualized lives, right? That other things or other people's influences or other people's paths get into our way. And in a way, when I write about openness, that's what I write, that in trying to become something, you have only so much control. There are all these other things that can happen. You get married to someone else. You are married to a less religious family. You can't find anyone to marry. So you're married off your cousin who doesn't want you to pray as much as you do because it spoils their image or whatever. And so, in a way, all of these contingencies are part of our lives, and individuals don't have that much control. And I almost found that Saba Mahmood's focus on so much on individuals and individuals self-cultivating, it really breaks that liberal conception of agency as resistance. But that liberal conception of an individual always choosing what they can do and being able to follow their own path, that, you know, that is actually kind of built into Saba Mahmood's analysis, and it's not something that she really challenges. And I try to challenge it by showing the different kind of positions that people find themselves in, and the fact that people don't always have control over their individual parts.
There's a line that you write, which I think encapsulates that. It's far from being an opiate, Sabr is active and charged with an anticipation of change. To understand Sabr, decenter the individual.
Yeah, so I think that's exactly kind of where time and suburb comes in, because, you know, I to kind of say this more ethnographically, I think the point that I was trying to make is that when you're in a place where you would have liked to have a particular kind of religious, I mean, so I think what I was really interested in seeing in through the lens of sabr is that when you are placed in a situation that you don't really want and you want something to change about it, right? So say you are in this marriage where your husband doesn't want you to be that religious. He doesn't want you to wear a headscarf, for instance, right? And you feel like you have to give in to this demand because Pakistan is this patriarchal society. You cannot leave this marriage. You're not economically independent enough to do it, and socially it wouldn't be accepted by your family. And so what you do in that context, or what, you know, some of our interlocutors do, is that they pray for something to change, and they do sabr and wait for that change to happen. And what that means is that they, you know, that can look like passivity, right? And what I do is that I challenge that idea, because there is this hope and this desire for change, and this change, and the hope is that this desire, this change could come from anywhere, right? And when it does come, you obviously say that, oh, I prayed for this to happen, but you also don't take full responsibility for it, right? You hide your agency, or you hide yourself in it a little bit. And so you kind of rely on the environment around you to bring the change that you want through your prayer, through your sabr, which has this then anticipatory and active charge to it. So To give you an example, in my paper, I talk about the person whose, you know, husband doesn't want her to wear a headscarf, and he wants her to be less religious. At a certain point in his life, the Tablighi Jamaat starts coming to his shop, and he finds, he used to own a shop in a center in Lahore, that he's becoming more and more religious, right? And now the way that the woman reads all of this is that she had been praying and she had been doing a lot of sabr for something to change, and something started changing in the attitude of her husband. And she just says, you know, maybe this was my destiny, or maybe this is something that I had prayed for, maybe something that had happened. So there's a lot of uncertainty around where that change came from. But at the same time, what it's also doing is that it's taking all of these chance and these contingency factors and shaping a narrative, right? That I was waiting for a change in my life, and look, this change has come.
You actually use the word patient, of being a patient of time.
Yeah, because I think I was playing around with, you know, that we are agents of time, or that we are agents when we're acting upon someone, right? But when we have to be acted on,
Then
then
we're
in a
patients.
way, then we're patients, yeah.
Listening to you talk about it, I'm thinking of a line that I once read in a Taoist text. I don't know exactly which one it was. And the line was, a woman is like low-lying land. In time, everything comes her way.
I mean, and there's both a beauty and a cruelty to it, right?
Of
Because
course.
I don't want to minimize how oppressive and how limiting a patriarchal society is for women, right? But then at the same time, I think what I want to do is to highlight that how working within those constraints also takes a lot of strength to make your life into something, right?
Yes.
And that trying to make your life into something, and the work and the labor and the sabr that goes into it, when you just say, oh yeah, these women are just so passive that they can't break out of the system, it's kind of disrespecting that work, that sabr, that labor that someone has done to build a life within those patriarchal constraints, right?
Yes, of course, you're
And
flattening a very complex existence.
yeah, flattening it, and also kind of taking away the work that it's taken to build something meaningful out of it. Even though, yeah, structurally it might be true that this is a system that oppresses you, and if you're not breaking out of it, you're going to be in this oppressive system, right? Like structurally, this is probably correct, but like you're saying, it's completely flattening out the amount of work and labor and sabr that goes into building something meaningful within those constraints.
It's very hard for people to conceive of a rich internal life for anybody, regardless of, you know, what their religious affiliations happen to be. And I think the beauty of your work is how you do that. You manage to give us the interiority of the people that you have spent time with. I don't know if you're comfortable using the term studied, because that makes you sound a bit like a lepidopterist, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say I put them all in this little, I put them under this magnifying glass. No, but I see what you mean. Actually, it's really funny that you're saying this. Because while we were talking and while you were saying this, I remembered how I had once presented this paper at a department seminar in another anthropology department. And someone said in the kindest of ways, she's like, oh, you know, this paper is so philosophical, but you know, to think that mothers with young children and running around after the kids, also doing the housework and also looking after the kitchens and stuff, that they would be also philosophizing. And on the one hand, it's true, right? Like women don't have the time to do all of that stuff, or the space like men do, ke yaar baith ke gappe marte. Like the women I work with really don't have very little time for those kind of, very little room to have those kind of gappe with other women, or like have that kind of independent leisure time, right? But on the other hand, it's not as if they don't dream of a different life, or it's not as if they haven't thought about these questions, despite the kind of busyness. And so I was really trying to bring it out. And the other reason I was finding your question really interesting is that as part of the work that I'm doing about Hindus in Karachi, I'm also working with these two artists and architects to do a digital installation. And one of those projects asks young mothers who are Hindu, that if you could change your house in any way, how would you change it, right? Like, what would your ideal space look like? And the idea behind it is that how do women imagine space in a country that doesn't give Hindus any space, right? And one of the really interesting things that comes out in when the women are talking to us is that, you know, everyone's kind of really hesitant in the beginning to say, oh, mujhe kya pata hoga, mujhe to nahi pata. Like, they're kind of almost surprised that they're being asked this question. But then as they start talking, they get really into it. And then quite a few of them have said that, oh, you know, you had to ask me this question for me to realize I have thoughts about all of this stuff and I would like things to be like this. And it felt really good being asked because it made me realize these are all the things that I've been thinking about and I want, but nobody ever asks me. And yeah, so like I, you know, just kind of when you were speaking, it reminded me that I guess we don't think about women's interior lives because we don't expect them to have them, or we don't see women, right, in Pakistani society.
And I don't think that's something that's restricted to Pakistani society too. And I think
No,
it also has to
definitely
do with
not.
language. So I think that your question, just the sound of your of those the words that you chose, would have unlocked a room in the mind. I'm sure you've heard of Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own, right? I was
Yeah.
recently reading another writer, I think it was Lydia Davis, talking about how women are always looking for room. But to find room outside, you have to access the rooms you already have inside, which is
Oh,
actually in a
wow,
way,
that
you know,
sounds really good. I would like to. Is it Lydia Davis, did you
it
say?
is Lydia Davis. I love her. So to unlock the room outside, you have to unlock the room inside first. And I'm about to come to language because I love your focus on language. And there's another paper you wrote, which has a great title, Love as Understanding, Marriage, Aspiration, and the Joint Family in Middle Class Pakistan. And I'd love it if you could keep telling us more about how your more recent field work is changing or deepening as a result of your older field work, whether one thing ran into the other, whether you're surprising yourself. But before I go off about that, there's another phrase that you use in this Time paper that I think is relevant, and that is silence as privacy. So often when women are silent, we think, oh, ismit to kuch jaani nahi hai ye to, you know, she's so passive, etc. But actually, sometimes silence can be privacy and it can be strength.
Yeah, I mean, in the Dime paper, I was talking about how, you know, that again, it kind of goes back to this earlier discussion we were having, that there's a lot of space for movement, or there's a lot of space for experimentation if you don't challenge the structures of authority, right? Which is patriarchy. And one of the ways in which you do that is through silence, and women kind of participate in this together. And so, for instance, coming up, you know, like in the paper I write about it in relation to someone who's married into this family, who log bahut zyada milad wagaira manate the, they were like from a Bareilvi family, and this woman herself, she had been to a lot of Quran schools and stuff and was more reformist in her thinking and did thought that milads are bid'ah, but then she's married into a family where her mother-in-law hosts one every month, but she doesn't want to go to it, right? So instead of saying, I don't want to go to it, I consider this bit that she kind of uses, oh, you know, my son was ill or it was this. And so both women know the excuse, it's probably an excuse, but because you're not challenging the truth outright, you're not saying the truth outright, because that would endanger the hierarchical structure of patriarchy, that the younger woman needs to abide to the older woman, it's fine, you know. And so similarly, these kind of moments allow you sort of selective privacy, as does silence. And so if you are not outrightly challenging something, silence can give you some maneuvering space.
So words actually create reality. And so if you don't use the words, you're not entering the arena of conflict. You're just staying outside of it.
Exactly. You're sidestepping it and focusing on the end result, right? Which is that you didn't want to go to this milad.
This other a paper that I was just talking about, the work of marriage and intimacy in the upwardly mobile classes in Pakistan, that followed on from your book, The New Pakistani Middle Class, which is the book that I first read and became a fan of your work through. But so this paper in particular about love and language, I'm going to call it the paper about love and language. I was actually going to say to you, so would it be fair to say this is a paper about love language? Because I know that's a popular culture term now.
Yeah, although what love language, I mean, the popular culture term love language means something slightly different. I guess that's more about how you show love, right?
I
Whereas,
have no idea. I have no love
I mean,
language.
this is what my understanding of love language is, that like, what is the way in which you show love? Whereas I guess this paper is about love and language, and it's about the language that people use to describe what it means for them to be in love or how they experience love, right? And in a way, it's also kind of like, it's, you know, it's trying to take seriously or consider seriously all these English words that seep into Urdu that, again, people tend to kind of laugh at, right? Or they just tend to be kind of funny. Which some of them obviously are, like, I'm not denying the funniness of it. Like, it's such a Pakistani thing to say, a building ki backside pe aa jaye, right? Rather than out
Bilkul.
uski back pe aa jaye. And so, yeah, we kind of laugh and it's funny. But also, you know, like you're saying, language words create reality. So in that
Yeah.
way, if you're using a word in a completely different context in Urdu, it's also creating maybe a different kind of reality that wouldn't exist in Urdu, right? And I was just trying to, in looking at the words people use to describe love and understanding, or, you know, in this case, it was about like pre-marital relationships, to say hamari aapas mein understanding hai. Like, what is that? What kind of reality is that creating, which is different from the reality that would have been there if they just used the word mohabbat or pyar or you know,
Or
whatever
even
Urdu word.
love.
Or even love, yeah, because love feels morally weird compared to understanding. That's what I say in the paper.
I mean, I found it a provocative line that there's something immoral about the idea of love marriage, and I definitely want to hear more about that. But I just, when you were saying this, I just thought, so they like to use the word understanding, the subjects in the paper, and they don't want to use the word pyar, and they don't want to use the word love. But actually, on Valentine's Day in Pakistan, there is such a stampede for flowers and for teddy bears, which say, I love you. So it's actually quite interesting. You can't vocalize the word love, but we do
Yeah,
adopt
I mean,
totems that have feature the word love. So
no,
what's up
for
with that?
sure. I think, I definitely think people say I love you to each other in English. But when I was saying people don't want to say that, oh, hamari love marriage hui thi, yeah, hum date kar rahe the, because that feels too filmy and that seems morally suspect, right? Whereas understandings, and that's kind of the point that I make, that understandings tries to bring the idea of love into a very domesticated idea of marriage as a responsible, good thing to happen in terms of family structures and so on. Whereas, and it kind of even tames the dangerous elements of love, which is that, you know, they are destructive of family or they're destructive of kinship relations because people are exercising their own choices and not their family. So understanding tries to bring, tame and domesticate love. But people do use, I mean, Valentine's Day, people love I love you cards. People might even say I love you to each other. But actually, people don't necessarily say mujhe tumse pyar hai ya mujhe aap se mohabbat. And actually, it sounds very awkward to say it, right? Like, there is something about the words pyar and mohabbat which can't be used in an I love you kind of way without it not sounding like an awkward construction.
I don't know. I mean, there was that Dr. and Billa song, Mujhe Tumse Nahi Hai Pyar, Toba
No, for
Toba
sure. I mean,
Astaghfar.
it is
That was
there.
such a great song.
No, I mean, it is there, but I think that there is something about, I think what I was trying to bring, draw out through when people use the word hamari understanding, and one is, of course, they want to not be like those filmy, irresponsible people
It's
that they
not
see in
Bollywood.
Bollywood
There's no
films. It's
ish.
not
There's no,
Bollywood, right?
yeah.
Yeah, there is no crazy ish. There's no this. This is a responsible, good thing. So they're like trying to make, like, in an environment where all of these things are seen as bad, they are trying to say, nahi, nahi, hum waise nahi. There was something else about this, right?
So we're not
But
dating. This is not date ni mare. But I want to
yeah, date
interrogate
nahi.
your use of morally suspect. The whole idea of morally suspect, do you mean desexualized? Because
Yeah,
there's
I mean,
these.
no, desexualized, and also that there is no frivolous contact. Like, frivolous, by frivolous, I mean is that, you know, if understandings always are said in this way that the intent is to get married. And the intent is that there is some serious intent behind it about how we want to live our life in the future, as opposed to date one. Now, which, yeah, you're right, that whether it's about sexual attraction or it's about frivolousness or it's about like temporary emotions, whereas understanding is seen as something that's kind of more staid and long term, right? And something that's been thought of with a responsibility. But one of the other things I wanted to say about the word understandings, that the way people use it, but what it also might be revealing about larger processes of change, is that, you know, typically when people write about or think about ishq or mohabbat in South Asian art or fiction or literary tropes, it's always seen as something that's dangerous or something that has the potential to disturb existing relations, right? Because it's seen as being very powerful, it's seen as an urge that does not want to conform to convention. Like, ek ashikana aadmi is like a pagal aadmi, right? That you're
I
not
mean,
in
by its
any way
nature, ishq is irrational.
exactly. And I think what understandings does is that it domesticates it and it turns it into a set of reciprocities, right? And it brings the reciprocities into a marriage also, which is quite interesting because marriages in patriarchal setups have unequal reciprocities, right? And whether understandings then, or people say hamari aapas mein understanding thi, whether that then makes a demand for a reciprocity that my husband should be caring because I'm caring, or my husband should do this because I do this for him. So there is this interesting change in what expectations are in a married life that come in through the word understanding, even if they're not perfect, even if there's still inequalities. I think it is quite, for me, it is quite interesting how the idea of understanding is beyond trying to domesticate and tame love. It's also bringing reciprocities into marriage.
It's aligning language with the structure that it's that underpins it. And in a Muslim context, for sure, I mean, a nikah is a marriage contract. It's not about love. It's not about ish. It's a business arrangement that, you know, two families, two people, two parties come to, that these are the terms of the contract, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's good that language is aligning with that. But have you found this to be true across religious communities since you're now working with Hindus in Karachi? Is it a similar language of love?
Around understanding?
Yeah.
And
Are there
that's
great
a very good
differences?
question. No, I mean, I think the differences are, some of the linguistic differences are that I work a lot with Dharti and Sindhi speaking Hindus, and so not as comfortable in Urdu. And so, but I mean, the word understanding is used still quite a bit, actually. I think it's just that the imperatives are slightly, I mean, I think the imperatives are just slightly different also, right? That when I'm working amongst Hindus in my current field work, marriage is also a big question about who you will marry and how you will marry. But there, you know, the big concerns that we kind of talk about is marrying out of the community. So marrying out of the caste group or marrying out of the religious group, Muslims, right? And so I feel that so much of the discussions of crossing boundaries brings in love, right? So we're like, "Haan unki love marriage thi, isliye," or whenever love is mentioned, it's mentioned in relation to crossing boundaries. And it's then people don't say, "Meri kisi Musliman ke saath understanding thi," or, you know, then it is like, oh.
There's also the term
Yeah.
free will marriage that used to pop up with great frequency in newspapers. Free will marriage. As in, even the paper
nobody,
didn't
yeah,
want
this
to
is
say
only
love
a
marriage.
yeah, this is a newspaper thing, by the way. I've never heard
Yeah,
anyone
because
say
what does
it.
that mean, right? Free will marriage. But the way we talk about love and entanglements in relationships or even encounters in Pakistani society, considering how many
Yeah.
languages there are, it's fascinating that the one word that eventually everyone is circled around to is understanding.
Yeah, but I think understanding is one of those, I want to say understandings in Pakistani English, or, you know, that English words used in Urdu, it's not just used for when people want to substitute saying dating or relationship or love. Like, it's not just used for those contexts. Like, I often hear people say, "Un logon ki aapas mein achhi understanding thi, to unhone khud hi sort out kar liya ye issue," right? Or you know, like, even if you're in a government office and someone says, "Ki agar aap thode se understanding ho, to hum ye kar sakte hain." Like, there's a way that understanding is used in a particular way. Or like, when someone wants to be helpful towards you, they say to you, "Ki, oh, kyunki aap bahut understanding hai, main ye kar leta hun." And that's a slightly different connotation of understanding. But, you know, it's used, I feel like understanding is a genuine English in Urdu, changing the meaning of the original kind of word.
And you use the term placeholder word for it,
Yeah, a
that understanding
placeholder,
is a
yeah.
placeholder. So it's like a white flag. It's basically, understanding is a word you use when you want to communicate or connect with another human being, but you haven't yet found the right formulation for your wordless feeling. So you hold up this linguistic white flag and then you both sit under it until you come to a conclusion. Okay, kya
Yeah,
ho
or
raha hai?
that, I mean, it's not just people, but it's also, I guess, culturally, right? Like, that there could be this, that if you don't have a word for it already, but it's also meaning that something is being renegotiated culturally, right? Not just amongst two people, then it kind of becomes a kind of placeholder. But it's like, you know, there are other words that are generally convey something slightly different from what they would mean in English, but have a real place. Like, I think maybe we talked about it last time we were speaking, like, feelings is one of those words, right? When someone says, "Maine bahut feel kiya," or, "Wo log बहुत उन लोगों ने कुछ भी नहीं किया मेरी शादी पे, तो मुझे बहुत फील हुआ, या मैं एक बहुत फील करने वाली इंसान हूँ. एंड फील इन दिस केस इज अबाउट नेवर फीलिंग एनीथिंग गुड, राइट? इट्स लाइक फीलिंग हर्ट, फीलिंग इंजरी, फीलिंग सैड और ह्यूमिलिएट. लाइक द फीलिंग इज ऑलवेज नेगेटिव एंड इट्स अबाउट द इंटेंसिटी ऑफ फीलिंग, राइट? मैंने मैंने बहुत फील किया, लाइक आई फेल्ट टू मच, व्हिच इन इंग्लिश साउंड्स रियली फनी, बट व्हेन यू से इट इन उर्दू इट प्रॉपरली मेक्स सेंस, यू नो, इफ यू अंडरस्टैंड द कॉन्टेक्स्ट एंड हाउ द वर्ड इज यूज्ड.
You had talked about in your paper Amir Mufti's work on exile and language, which I found fascinating. And I think it's sort of related to this. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I'm going to say which paper you read that had this, because that paper hasn't been published as yet. But
Oh, no, we'd mentioned it. And so I think basically
oh, we did
you
talked about it. Yeah.
yeah,
Yes, I
the
was like,
closing off
wow,
of
this is so cool.
avenues.
She can read my mind that I wrote something like a few
हमारी
months ago she's
अंडरस्टैंडिंग हो
already.
गई है इसलिए
Yeah, हमारी भाई मैंने बहुत फील की है बात. Yeah, so you know, Amir Mufti makes, in my mind, this really beautiful point that Urdu is a language in exile because it's been cut off from its roots, right? I mean, he makes a bigger point than this, but I'm just bringing out what I want from it, that there was a time that people who spoke Urdu were people who, or it was a culture that was well versed in Arabic, Sanskrit, Persian, and Urdu comes as something that you speak that comes out of these traditions, that people that are familiar with these traditions or live immersed in these traditions speak. And therefore, in a way, when the language needs to grow, it has these kind of resources to grow out of these cultures from which it is also developing, right? And when it kind of gets cut off from that root and is taught as this national language in its own right, it has nowhere to grow from in that sense. And in that sense, it almost feels like now when we need to borrow, say there's a word you need for something in Urdu that doesn't exist and you don't know Farsi, but you do speak English, that's where you borrow it from, right? You know, we can take it two ways. Yeah, we can say this as an example that Urdu is a language in exile, that it's been cut off from its root, and that root was not a singular nation ever. It was a very multi-religious, multi-ethnic sort of space from which it emerged. And when you kind of just link it to this one fixed nation, that brings all the, you know, issues of that the language doesn't have space to grow. But at the same time, you know, you can also be like, okay, I shouldn't think that just because we are borrowing from English, that's impure. We can also say, hey, the language needs to grow. And now this is the way that we grow. We borrow words from English, but we take those words into Urdu and they take on a slightly different meaning, right? And in a similar way that English does, actually, we recently had this discussion with a copy editor for this edited volume that I'm doing with two people, where the copy editor was really displeased by the fact that words like chalk, or you know, these kind of very Urdu words like Maulvi or something had been used in the text without any translation. And we really had to fight back against that and say, no, these are not words that need to be translated, because English has also, in its long contact with South Asia, come to use these words, right? And we shouldn't always want to think about languages to be untainted or pure, that any word that's even slightly foreign sounding should be put into brackets and translated and stuff. It's that this is what happens when languages and cultures come into contact.
Did they not know it was 2024?
I mean, I don't know who the copy editor was, and I think that they were just trying to do a good job. But a lot of these words are also actually in the Oxford English Dictionary, right? Like chalk, Maulvi. And so we just said, I think if they're in the Oxford English Dictionary, you can use them. And yeah, so I mean, and it was fine. They agreed. Once we kind of said it was fine, but it had to be said.
So I wonder if this idea, the fact that we are cut off, and I think this is not just true of Urdu, right? Would you say it's also true of Punjabi, for example?
For sure.
I
I
mean, उधर
think
तो फिर वो divergence, even in the written form, it's completely different now. Shahmukhi and Gurmukhi, and you know, on both sides of the border, people can speak.
absolutely. Absolutely. I think that this is probably true for a lot of languages. And it's particularly true in Pakistan and India for languages that might be spoken similarly but have now divergent scripts. And so there's less space for exchange. And also that we don't study Punjabi in schools, for instance, which makes it even harder than to have that kind of command where a language, you know, where you can make the language grow from within the kind of root words that might already be available, but it's just that we're not familiar with them because we're not taught Punjabi.
Do you think this is why the younger generation is now so interested in memes, because it's they're creating their own language?
I definitely feel like memes are a new language, and it's a new way to communicate, and it communicates a lot more than just the meme itself, right? Because they're all connected. But whether it has to come out of that other language is a dead end, or just that memes are able to convey something that's a little more, and it meets or it suits a generation, I'm not, you know, like maybe it has something to do with that. I want to admit that I feel old when I say this, that I find these very funny, but I am definitely not someone who considers this to be my new language, right? But I definitely encounter, especially amongst my students, people whose whole life could be communicated through memes, right?
I have a 22-year-old, a 19-year-old, and an 8-year-old. And one of them said to me the other day when I was WhatsApping something that nobody uses punctuation. It's very aggressive.
What?
And
No punctuation.
Yeah. Like if I use punctuation, it's aggressive. It's an act of aggression. So,
I can understand a double exclamation mark to be an act of aggression. Like whenever I read an email and someone has double exclamation marks, I get a little like, wait, why are you being so aggressive?
Yeah.
But any punctuation, that feels excessive.
Apparently, I don't know. Kya pata, mera apna beta mujhe chup karane ke chakkar mein laga ho. This is also a
I mean, who knows? I mean,
yeah.
All of that said, like, who am I to say anything on memes? My whole life, I can say an emoji, right? It would be like that laughing, crying emoji. I mean, that's kind of my answer to everything, right? It can answer pretty much, it can be a response to pretty much everything. How are you? Laughing, crying emoji. Answer to something, laughing, crying emoji.
The fieldwork that you're doing now, what's that going to lead to? And what can we expect from you next?
Good things, I hope. At the moment, so the fieldwork is going to definitely lead to some articles, maybe some more publicly facing work also. But what we're really excited about, which is probably going to emerge in a few months, is that we worked on a digital installation, which comes out of not just my work on Hindus living in Karachi and their experience of upward mobility there, but also the kind of larger project that I was talking about with people in southern Italy and in Kenya, and looking at these kind of religious minorities or interreligious interactions. We've created this digital, we did some projects with artists and architects and photographers that we're trying to bring together in this digital installation, which is called The Absent Present. And it really tries to bring out exactly these things that I'm saying, that how do you make space for a community that isn't given that much space? Or how do they imagine space? Or, you know, thinking about how do you see signs of a different kind of interreligious world or religious presence that is now no longer there? So, you know, someone in Palermo, how they might be able to see the Islamic path in the city in a particular place. And so it's called The Absent Present. And
beautiful
we hope
title.
That it will be. Yeah, it comes out of Derrida's work, but it's a beautiful title, and I hope it is a beautiful installation. I hope that it's something that we can engage with people sometime next spring. And then we have, you know, the usual fare of academic articles that will come out of this project.
Well, I'm looking forward to all of this stuff already. And obviously it would be a digital installation because that's the only way, since you're all so spread out across the globe, to allow maximum access, right?
Yeah, I mean, some of it is because, you know, these are projects that we have done at our field sites in Karachi, in Palermo, in Nairobi, and then we're linked to universities in the UK. But one of the reasons, and so it made sense to kind of have it digital, but the other reason it really made sense is that the people that we've done field work with are not really the kind of people who are going to turn up at an art gallery in Karachi or even an art gallery in Nairobi, right? But there are people who will look it up on their phones and they would be really, really interested. And I think sometimes when you are producing very cool, very artsy stuff, the way that you present them or the way that you let people access them really then limits the kinds of people who can come to it. And so we were really keen that we really want to reach out to people who might feel a bit intimidated going into art gallery, or it's not just part of their normal life to do stuff like that, but they will pick up a phone and scroll through something on the phone, right? There's also just the physical problem of accessibility, right? That if
Yeah.
you're, if you are a woman who lives in a faraway place in Garden East in Karachi, for instance, and you have to wait for your husband to come home and take you shopping or to all the, places that you usually go, you have to be taken somewhere, then what are the chances you guys are going to make it to an art gallery, So it's a little bit about it is about definitely the gatekeeping that happens around the world of art through class and through social outlook and dispositions and stuff, which is not just something that's about Pakistan. It's about the whole
Yeah.
world, I think, that art tends to be something that, cool, glitzy, glam people do and other people don't have access.
No, they just live.
They just live. And the other bit is just about, that all these things that get in the way of you going out and enjoying good art, whether it's the physical inaccessibility, it's the fact that you would feel a little out of place, or it's the money that you might have to spend on the ticket or conveyance to get there. And so whether you can just reach a diff, you can reach that audience if things are digital.
I have one final question for you, Amara, then I'm going to let you go because you've already given me an hour and I really appreciate it. And that is your work. So this is going to be a digital installation with your partners, and the papers and the book that I've mentioned are in English. In academic publishing, is this stuff translated?
No, that's a really good question. I mean, I would very much like to make my work more accessible. I think some of what I'm trying to do to be more public facing, to do this digital installation, is to try to reach an audience outside of academic circles, but it's still an audience that can speak and read English. And I would really wish and hope that my work can be translated into Urdu so that it can reach a wider audience. I feel ashamed, but I also want to be honest enough to say that this is what happens when you go to school in Pakistan, where you do study Urdu, but your medium of instruction is English. And then
Yeah.
later you go on to universities that are also teaching you in English, that no matter how comfortable you are speaking Urdu otherwise, you are unable to do academic speak in Urdu. And you're unable to translate your academic ideas into Urdu. And this happens to me a lot. And it's something that I try to work at. But it's something that if someone would help me with in translating my work into Urdu, I would very much like.
Well, I really hope that happens, and I'm sure it'll happen because your work is phenomenal. One final note, sorry, I know I said I was going to end this. You used the word shame just now, and I was thinking that sharam is another word that means so many different things.
Yeah, and it's both
Washa.
positive and negative, right?
Yes.
That
Yeah.
if you feel sharam, you're like a moral person, but then you can also feel sharam for your inadequacy.
Yeah. So it was such a pleasure talking to another word nerd. Bye.
Thank you, Shandana. Thank you for giving me this time. Bye.